Since then, you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things, or seek things above, not earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Kill, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and the greed, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming. Let's bow in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, as we approach this text, I pray that you would enable me to teach this passage in a way that is faithful to what you would have said this morning. I ask that you prevent me from saying any extraneous comments that are not helpful in understanding this text. I pray that you would enable me to make all the comments that are necessary for understanding it and for edifying and encouraging everyone here. And I pray that you would enable all of us to put out of our minds any distractions that we might focus on this very, very important passage. I pray this in your holy name. Amen. You've tried to achieve self-control in your life before with various different methods. And I want you to think for a minute about what you've tried. What is it that you have tried and has not worked when it comes to achieving self-control? You've tried trying harder, and that doesn't seem to work. You've tried accountability. You've tried rewards and punishments. You've tried every self-help technique you can think of, and still left with a situation where you're unable to control your impulses. How does a person gain mastery over himself, and is it really that important? What does Scripture say? Well, let's take a look at this passage. Just a little bit of review first. We found in the last several times that we are to seek and think on things above. We are to set our minds on things above. Think from a spiritual, eternal perspective rather than a temporal, earthly perspective. That requires discipline. When you become lazy in your thinking and allow your thoughts to become earthly, it doesn't seem like there's really any damage done initially, but in the weeks to come, you pay the price. Your life sinks into shallowness and powerlessness and vulnerability to sin and preoccupation with small, trifling things and superficial relationships, and then a frightening loss of interest in worshiping the true God. That's the price we pay for earthly thinking. And so he says, set your mind on things above. And then in verse 3 he says, because you died. Reason number one for doing that is you died. You've been released from that prison. Why go back to that voluntarily? And secondly, your life is now hidden with Christ in God. You're so closely, totally identified with Christ that it's beneath you and unfitting for you to have an earthly mindset. You are going to appear with Christ when He comes in glory. And then we get to verse 5. And that's where we're going to pick it up this morning. Put to death, kill, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Then he gives a list of sins. The phrase earthly nature is a fascinating phrase. It means literally the parts, kill the parts that are upon the earth. And the word parts means body parts. Kill the members of your body, the body parts of you that are upon the earth. What does that mean? Well, what are our parts? I think the NIV has a pretty good idea here with whatever belongs to your earthly nature. If you look at the list of sins, this list of sins is what he's talking about. The body parts that are upon the earth is this list of sins, sexual immorality, impurity, and so on. And every one of them, if you look at them, it has to do with a desire of some kind. These are sins of taking. And it's interesting that he describes these desires as parts or members of your body. We have talked in detail, and we talked even on Easter about how when you are a Christian, you are sanctified, and the Lord, your life has changed, and you turn your back on sin. You give up the old life of sin. Nevertheless, sin is still very much a part of our lives as Christians, isn't it? I mean, there's just no escaping that. And this passage puts it in as strong a terms as you can ever find. Even with your new nature, sinful desires are so much a part of you that they're referred to here even as your own body parts. Even as a believer. You've died to this world. And you've been released from the temporal, the prison of the temporal. But the picture here, the illustration here, is that there are still things tying you to this earth. It's like while you were in the prison officials tied ropes. They tied a rope to each leg and tied a rope to each arm and your hands and around your neck and everything. So you're released from the prison, but you're still attached with all these ropes. And so what he's saying here is, cut those. The solution to the problem of being too attached to this world is pretty simple. Just cut the ropes. And the ropes are these desires that are inside us that draw us back down to the earth when we're trying to ascend towards heaven. He says, cut those off. Cut off anything that draws you earthward while you're trying to ascend heavenward. If you were in some sort of a disaster scene and your hand or your foot got stuck and you absolutely could not get it free, and within moments the place where you were is about to be destroyed, if you could, I mean, it would make the sensible thing to do would be to actually cut off your hand or foot so that you could escape and save yourself, right? That's the picture here. These things that are tying you to this place that's about to be destroyed, and we'll see that in verse 6, whatever's tying you to that, cut it off so you can escape. Now, how do we reconcile? Some people have wondered, how do we reconcile the fact that it says you died in Christ already earlier, and now it's saying, therefore, put to death. Verse 3 says you died. Verse 5 says, put to death those things. And how is it that we can reconcile those two things? And the answer is, at conversion, there is a death in a sense that there is an official break with the world. Now there needs to be some practical, specific acts of severing ties with the world. You see, when you were an unbeliever, basically what was happening is you were committing adultery with the world, right? You belong to God, and yet you are devoted to the world. And that was like an adulterous relationship. And if you can imagine a person in an adulterous relationship who decides to cut it off, there comes a moment in time when they say, okay, I'm cutting it off. I'm breaking it off. And you call the person up and say, it's over. I'm not going to see you anymore. And if that's the moment, that's analogous to what happened when you became a Christian. But in the days that follow, if somebody were in a situation like that, what else would they have to do? There are specific ties that they'd have to cut that had to be broken. Maybe the guy, sees her phone number in his wallet or something. He realizes, oh, I need to throw that away. Or maybe he comes across a photo of her and he has to get rid of that. And later he realizes, boy, my job makes me so I have to stop by her office all the time. Maybe I need a new job or whatever. And so one thing after another, each little piece that was those connecting pieces needs to be severed. And that's the way it is for the Christian. You've already broken it off with the world, but you have some remaining ties in the form of desires that drag you down to this earth, and those need to be cut. So how do you kill a desire? You want something. How can you help wanting something? Well, that's what we're going to learn in this passage. And this is a fantastic passage. I love passages like this because this is one of those ones that instead of just telling you what to do, it tells you how to do it. It gives you information about how to manage it. And so that's very, very helpful. So let's take a look. Whenever you study the Bible, your goal always is to find out what is the purpose of that passage, remember? And then the goal is just simply to fulfill the purpose. Whatever that purpose is. The purpose here is very, very easy to spot. It's not very hard because there's a command. There's an imperative. Kill. Put to death. So that's the purpose, is to get you to do that. And so that's my purpose this morning. How do you kill a desire? Turn to Romans 4. This is an interesting word. At first glance, it doesn't really seem like Colossians 3. This passage in Colossians 3 actually does tell us how. It seems to just say, kill those desires. Just kill the desires, and then it doesn't tell you how to kill the desires. But if we look very closely, we can find that actually there is information here on how to do it. The word translated put to death, when it says put to death this list of sins, that is a fascinating term. I looked that up when I was studying this. I was thinking to myself about, when I first thought, I thought, oh brother, this is going to be tough because it's another one of those passages that doesn't tell how, and I wasn't expecting this, and so I was just looking it up, and I expected this word put to death to just be the normal word for death, thanatos, or the verb form to kill, and that's what I expected. It wasn't that. It's a different word. It's a rare word. It's only used three times in the whole Bible, here in Colossians and then in Romans 4 and in Hebrews 11. In both Romans 4 and Hebrews 11, it refers to the exact same thing. Look at verse 18 of Romans 4. It says, against all hope, Abraham in hope believed so became the father of many nations. Just as has been said of him, so shall your offspring be. Without weakening in his faith, he faced, now get this, he faced the fact that his body was as good as dead. Since he was about 100 years old, and Sarah's womb was also dead, God said, Abraham, you're going to have a baby. Abraham says, I'm 100 years old. My wife's 90. Come on, and yet you would expect that, but really that's not what his response was. Instead, his response was belief. He believed it would happen. He didn't waver at all in his faith because he trusted God, even though his body was as good as dead. And that's the phrase. That's the same word. That whole phrase, as good as dead, is just our word here, put to death. It's the exact same word. There's no words in the Greek for as good as. You could just mark those out. That's just the NIV translators helping you understand a little bit of the sense. So if we translate it the same way it is in Colossians 3, it would come out this way. Abraham faced the fact that his body had been put to death since he was 100 years old and his wife's womb was also dead. Now, you don't have to turn to the Hebrews 11 passage. I'll just read it to you, but it says the exact same thing. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he, having been put to death, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. Now, what does this word mean? Had Abraham been put to death? Of course not. He was still alive. What kind of death is this? We see that it's not a literal dying, physical dying. Both these passages refers to an impotence that's a result of old age. It's a fascinating word. In fact, you can go back to Colossians 3 now. The word comes from a root that was a medical term that referred to any part of the body that ceased functioning as a result of atrophy. And they would use this word to describe that. So the idea here in Colossians 3 is not so much just to kill something, but rather to neglect it to the point where it just withers on the vine by itself and dies. That's the picture from the words that are used. I mean, that's the picture the original readers would have immediately picked up on. You died to this world, therefore let your earthly desires just kind of choke off and wither on the vine as a result of not being fed. How do you do that? I want you to imagine for just a second that you're back in school and there's a bully who always terrorizes you. The bully's name is Sarks, and he's far bigger than you, far stronger than you, totally dominates you. And so you complain to the principal, ask for help, and he responds, the principal responds, by giving you Sarks' meal ticket. So that's all he does. So now, from now on, Sarks can never eat anything unless you feed him. A couple of weeks later, Sarks is no problem. After 2 weeks of not eating, he's so weak that he's no problem to you at all, no threat to you at all, and he's never any threat. Anytime he gets to be a threat, you can weaken him by not feeding him. You can keep him as weak as you want. The Greek word for flesh is sark. That's the bully. And you can do that same thing with your own fleshly desires. If you refuse to feed the flesh, it will weaken, and you can keep it as weak as you want. If you do feed it, you just stoke the fires of all those desires, and you make them so strong that they can dominate you. For example, just take Paul's example here of sexual sin. If your life is totally dominated by sexual sin, you may try to eliminate that sin. You say, okay, I've got sinful behavior in my life. I'm going to try and eliminate that. What I'll do is I'll remove, say, pornography or something. And so you remove that. Then you click on the TV and you watch something that is not pornographic in any way, but worldly enough to where it just feeds those desires and excites those desires. And the whole purpose, I mean, that's the whole purpose of commercials, right? Any commercial, that's the whole purpose, is to generate a sense of discontent with your life and make you want something that you don't already have. And so, you know, you watch that, you just feed the flesh, you feed your earthly desires, and you make them so strong that they can dominate you when it comes to tempting you towards sin. Let's look at this list. The list moves from the specific to the general, and from the surface to the core. He starts out with something very specific sin. Sexual immorality. The word is porneia. It's a broad term for any sexual activity outside of marriage, any physical sexual activity other than with one spouse. There's a whole range of physical activity that leads up to intercourse, and this term includes any of that activity with anyone you're not married to. Everything from a sensual touch or a kiss or a sensual kind of a hug all the way to the most extreme perversions of sex, all of it is included in this word porneia. Very often singles will ask, how far can we go? And the answer to that question is very simple. Nowhere. You can't go at all on that road. Anything that's, I mean, as soon as you set foot on that, on the road of physical sexual expression with somebody that you're not married to, you are on the road of porneia. This is a very high standard, and this is an issue that keeps many, many people out of Christianity. There are a number of people, I know some, who reject Christianity for no other reason than this one reason. It's just too high of a sexual ethic. They cannot control that, and so they're not willing to give that up. Tremendous problem in our society, and we go on and on about that, but I don't want to get sidetracked on that because we need to see the flow of this list to understand the passage. It goes from sexual immorality, then he says to impurity. Impurity is a word that just simply means dirty, contaminating, or disgusting. It's a little bit broader term. It includes not just... Sexual immorality is talking about actions. Impurity refers also to not only actions, but also thoughts. Everything leading up to porneia. This would include pornography. And by the way, exposing yourself to pornography is sin. If you haven't figured that out, I should probably just say that. That is sin. According to average statistics, there are probably a fairly high percentage of men in this room right now who have looked at pornography on the internet this last week. It's an incredible problem. And guys, if you're struggling with that, I can help you. Wives, and if you need help with this, I'd be glad to help you, but wives, just go into the C drive, look under Windows and Temporary Internet Files. In that directory, you can arrange icons by date and see the most recent things that have been viewed on your computer on the internet. You'll know immediately by the names of the files if there's been any pornography. If that file is empty, you know that your husband is always also listening to this sermon, and that's a cause of alarm. If your husband has been on the internet, that thing would be jammed full. You only have to be on the internet 10 minutes and that file has tons of stuff in it. Check that regularly. That's a huge problem for many, many men, and it's something that we need to address with drastic measures. But there's other problematic forms of pornography besides the internet. Movies, R-rated movies, PG-13 rated movies with either nudity or sensuality, something that excites the interest. Even basic cable, even if you just look at channels, so there's some channels, entertainment channel or whatever, that has just things that are designed to do absolutely nothing but excite lust. That's pornography. Popular TV shows like that show Friends. That's all the show is about. In fact, it's really pretty much any sitcom. All you have to do is watch any TV and an advertisement comes on for a sitcom and you can tell from the advertisements what those things are all about. That's pornography. And there's pornography for women too. Pornography for men is mostly pictures. Pornography for women is mostly more along the lines of thinking about some other person besides your spouse and imagining some sort of a romantic encounter with another man. That's often described in, comes in the form of romance novels, or you see it as soap operas. Everybody gets around to everybody in bed sooner or later in every soap opera. Ephesians 5:3 says, among you, there must not even be a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity. Not even a hint. Now just ask yourself, can you honestly say that the things that you watch and the things that you read and the things that you listen to in music, that can you honestly say there is no hint of impurity here? That's the standard of Ephesians 5:3. Literally what Ephesians 5:3 says is those things should not even be mentioned in your midst. Now let me ask you a deep, difficult theological question. If you are watching a TV show and the people on the TV show discuss impure things, are there impure things being discussed in your midst? The answer is yes. People do not engage in sinful sexual activity apart from having had a pattern of sinful sexual thoughts. Nobody just falls into the act. Those who do, you know what they've been thinking about, you know what their thought life has been like for a long period of time. It's just pure cause and effect. You cannot think along one track and act on a different track for very long. They'll match sooner or later. Your actions will follow your thoughts just as surely as night follows day. So, you see that the sexual sin comes out of the sexual thoughts. The actions come out of the thoughts. So let's look at the third thing in the list, lust. The word here is pathos. A better translation in this context would probably be drives. Your pathos or your pathoi, your drives, are those underlying drives that push your thoughts and actions along a certain line. It's an orientation. It comes from the word, this is a real interesting word, pathos, because it comes from the word for suffering. The Greek word for suffering. The idea is your drives are those things that you want so badly that it hurts not to have them. So, it's back to the internal. Well, I mean, this is still part of the internal, but this includes actions as well. Just think of the things in your life that you cannot change no matter how hard you try. You can't change those things because you have drives that are working in opposition to your efforts to change. And then below the drives even, it comes another thing that causes the actual drives, and that is evil desires. Epithumia is just a strong, it means it's a word for strong desire. The drives are the way they are because we have deep-seated, powerful desires. You say, well, where do the desires come from? I know the actions come from the thoughts. Thoughts come from the drives come from the desires. Where do the desires come from? How can I change those? And then look at the bottom of the list. Here's where it all comes down to the final thing that shows us how to understand this. That comes from greed. And a lot of people have been alarmed to see that at the end of the list here. Greed? You know, where's that coming from? I mean, there's a whole list of things that are always connected with sexual sins, and all of a sudden, greed. Does that fit? Literally, it's the greed. There's an article there. Specific greed. Which greed? Which greed is it? It's the greed, it's the greed, it's the Ten Commandments greed. This is the word pleonexia. It's the exact same word in the Greek form in the Old Testament in the Ten Commandments of commandment number 10. Thou shalt not covet. Same word. Greed and covetousness are the same thing. This is the greed that was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. It's very important to God that we understand this. You know, I think it was R.C. Sproul or somebody said, if you could imagine this, just imagine that the law code in the United States got too complicated, too difficult, and so they just took the whole thing, just threw it in the trash, and they appointed you to rewrite a law code in the United States, and they said, this time we want to keep it simple. Just 10, no more. Just come up with 10 laws that we can use as guidelines and nothing else. Imagine trying to do that. Now, I'm sure everyone would have, you know, you're not allowed to murder and you're not allowed to steal and all that. But how about this one? Would you waste one of the 10 on you're not allowed to covet? God did. Commandment number 10, thou shalt not covet anything. We're not allowed to have greed in our hearts. And it's so important to God that He made it one of the 10 commandments. Why is it so important to God? In fact, look at verse 6 in Colossians 3. He says, because of these, the wrath of God is coming. Now, wrath is a strong term. That's not just talking about the frown of God. This is, the word wrath, thumos, it describes an angry rage. The sin of covetousness is so abhorrent to God, His entire being recoils at it and reacts against it. Why is it such a big deal? We certainly don't take it that seriously. 1 Corinthians 5 lists this as one of the specific things that is cause for excommunication from the church. If you have somebody greedy in the church, 1 Corinthians 5 has nothing to do with that person. Put him out. When have you ever heard of anyone being disciplined out of a church and excommunicated because he had greed in his heart? We just tend to laugh it off. I heard just this week about an old priest, who, very old guy. He had been a priest and listened to confessions for decades. And he said, I've heard it all, but one thing I've never heard, I've never ever heard anybody confess the sin of covetousness. And we just don't take it seriously. We don't think it's a problem. Jesus took it seriously. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5:29, when Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go where? To be thrown into hell. Wow, that's pretty strong language. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, folks, you're maybe inoculated to that language, but think about how startling this is. Jesus said, if you don't control your passions and desires, you will go to hell. And some of you might be shocked that I just said that. If I don't control my lust, I'm going to go to hell? That's just exactly what Jesus said. How can we interpret it any different? Covetousness, greed in our heart is a very, very serious sin. The word literally means to desire more. It's a compound word from the word desire and the word more. It just means you want more all the time. Luke 12:15 says, Jesus said to them, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of pleonexia, greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Greed is this constant craving for abundance, not just of things, possessions, but in this context, whatever it is you want, craving more of it all the time. There's something that you want in life, and you decide you're not going to be happy until you have more of that thing. That's greed. If you're not content with the way things are now, with what God has given you, that's greed. Greed is the ultimate liar. It tells you that you can be satisfied if you just feed it more. It never tells you that it plans to keep you in bondage to discontent for the rest of your life. It lies to you and tells you that once you get this thing, that's the last time, and now then it'll be satisfied, it won't bug you again, it'll be happy. But the moment you get that thing, it makes a new demand, and it goes on forever. You can no sooner satisfy the heart of greed than you can fill up a jar that has no bottom. That's what it's like, trying to satisfy it. It's a lack of faith. It's a failure to trust that if you just commit to following what God wants you to do, God will provide for you whatever measure of comfort and pleasure and enjoyment that He wants you to have, and that's enough. Living with discontent, living with the idea that your circumstances around you need to change before you can have joy and fulfillment in your life, is no different than the guy who just stockpiles money because he doesn't trust God to provide for him in the future. And this is the core of the problem. It's the root of the whole list. All sins of taking. Now, we'll talk about sins of giving in the next list in weeks to come. But all sins of giving come out of greed, covetousness. In fact, if you look at the back side of your outline, you'll see a picture there of a tree, and you can see how this list works. It's all rooted out of the greed. And everything else grows out of the greed, grows the desires. Out of those desires grow the drives. Out of those drives grow the impurity. And out of the impurity come finally the sinful actions. And the reason people don't confess the sin of covetousness is because they don't see that as the root of the sin, which is exactly the way Satan wants it. Because he knows that he can keep you constantly defeated if you're up there trying to cut off leaves off the tree and you're not doing anything to cut the root. We need to kill the covetousness. Now, how do you kill covetousness? How do you address it at the root? Well, you kill covetousness with contentedness. Contentment kills greed. They can't live together. Contentment is a decision to say to God, I don't want anything other than what you're going to provide for me. That's contentment. It's a real matter of faith because you have to trust that God is good enough and generous enough to take better care of you than greed will. That takes faith. And if you want to know the real object of worship in your life, fill in the blank. In order to be satisfied, I have to have what? Whatever you fill in there, that's the object of worship in your life. Which is exactly what he says. Look back at Colossians 3. He says, get rid of the greed, which is idolatry. Greed is the same thing as idol worship. They're the exact same thing. Idolatry is always a result of greed. Man decides he doesn't want to deny himself. He doesn't want to conform to God's demands. He has certain drives and passions and desires and pleasures that he's not willing to set aside for God. And still, though, he still wants to be religious. And so he invents a God that won't impinge on his greed. And that's idolatry. He still wants to have a God because you need someone up there to give you the things you want. But he doesn't want to give up anything too much that's precious to him, and so he invents a God that will give him what he wants but who won't make too many demands on his deep affections. So whenever you have idolatry, no matter what form it takes, the false God being worshipped ultimately is whom? Self. You might set up a statue and a shrine and a whole religious system and invent all that, but if you look closely at the statue, you'll see your own face there. It's a God who demands exactly as much from you as you were already willing to give and no more. And in our culture, we tend not to have the statues. We're not we don't think of ourselves as an idolatrous culture because we don't have all the statues. We just dispense with the statue, the pretense of the statue, and we just come right out and admit the core of the issue. Yeah, I'm living for myself. I put myself first. I mean, that's what our culture says. But whether you bother with a statue or not is really totally irrelevant. It's idolatry either way. So we find out that 10 equals 1. Commandment number 10 is the same as commandment number 1, isn't it? Thou shalt not covet is the same thing as saying, no other gods before me. Not even the God of self. Especially not the God of self. And that's why it's such an important issue to God. That's why covetousness and greed is such an important issue to God, because it's idolatry. Matthew 6:24, Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. He'll either hate the one and despise the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and hate the other. You cannot serve both God and things. Living to get things and to fulfill your earthly desires is as being a servant to another master, devoting your life to another master, and that's idolatry. It's the worship of another God, the God of self. And it really is worship. I mean, don't kid yourself. When you get to that, when you have greed in your heart, you do everything to serve that God of getting. You make it your portion. You give it your first thought in the morning, your last thought at night, and all of your service in every waking hour. That, folks, is worship. The reason you can't worship both is because God calls you to give up living for pleasure and fulfillment of earthly desires. And so if you live in fulfillment of earthly desires as your priority, you've turned your back on God. You ever wonder why sexual sin and idolatry are always connected in Scripture? You just go through the Old Testament. Everywhere you look, whenever there's idolatry, there's sexual sin. And I'm not going to read you this list. Let me just read you one. 1 Corinthians 10:7. I'll just read it. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink, and they got up to indulge in revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality. See that? It's idolatry. At the beginning of the verse, at the end of the verse, it's sexual immorality. They're always connected. Whenever you read about pagan religions, you read about things like temple prostitutes, orgies, homosexuality, every other kind of sin, as well as drunkenness. And the reason for that is that's how they worshipped. That was actually what they did to worship. Right there in the temple, the act of worship was literally the sex act. That's what they did. That's why the prostitutes were there in the temple. Have you ever wondered why it was so hard for Israel to give up idolatry? That used to really puzzle me. I'd read the Old Testament, and God would just judge Israel with such harsh judgments. And he just said, stay away from idolatry. Don't worship those idols. And they would always keep falling back into worshiping the idols. And the prophets would come and warn them, say, you're going to be judged. Horrible things are going to happen to you if you keep worshiping these idols. Stop worshiping. And they couldn't stop. And I've always, you know, just racked my brain. Why? What is so hard about not bowing down in front of a piece of wood? Why is that such a temptation to fall down in front of a big piece of wood or a rock? How hard is it to give that up? The thing we need to understand, the reason it was so hard is because it's not that they liked bowing down in front of a piece of wood. They just liked what that piece of wood let them do. It let them fuel the god of self and live in constant responsiveness to the god of self, the desires of the inner man, and that's what they couldn't give up. They wanted to live a life of responding to impulses. So greed to fulfill your desires is idolatry. It's worship of self. Ephesians 5, that parallels this, Colossians 3, says the exact same thing. Among you, there shouldn't even be a hint of sexual immorality, that's pornea, any kind of impurity, that's the same word impurity, or of greed, that's pleonexia. Because these are improper for God's holy people. Verse 5, for of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of God. It's idolatry. The biggest question in life is, who are you going to follow? Who are you going to love and who are you going to worship? Are you going to love and worship God or self? And if you truly worship God, you're going to have to, you go to God, and worship of God is just going to God and say, God, what do you want me to do? And God says, I want you to do this. And you say, fine, that's what I plan on doing. The other alternative is to worship self and say, self, what do you want? And self says, I want that. You say, well, wait a minute, God's forbidden that. It doesn't matter. I want that. And you respond to that. That's worship of self. And that's the only two options. And so self says, I want that. We bow the knee and submit to that. And that idolatrous act of looking to self and responding to what its impulses is the sin of covetousness. And from that sin are generated strong desires. And those desires issue out in drives that will push your thoughts into a certain pattern until ultimately it issues in the deed. Those deeds are just the fruit of all that process. And most people try and remedy the problem of sin in their lives and lack of self-control by being way up at the top of the tree and lopping off a few leaves here and there, and they just can't understand why the leaves just keep growing back. And some people think it through a little more, and they say, oh, it's not the leaves, the problem is the branches. So they'll go down to a few of the, you know, the smaller branches and cut those. They try and address their thought life. But they try to address their thought life and they run up against a brick wall there because they realize, boy, I try and adjust my thoughts, but I can do it for a moment, I can do it for a little bit, but as soon as I leave my quiet time, my devotions, I'm right back into these same sinful thought patterns. And the reason is because they have drives that are pushing their thoughts along these sinful lines. And most people, if they can trace it all the way back to there and see the drives, and they generally throw up their hands and say, I can't do anything about that. That's part of who I am. Those are my drives. How can I change that? And I'm just doomed to just live like this. Other people will try and change their drives. And they'll use all kinds of... They'll try therapy, or they'll try accountability, or they'll try self-help. They'll try all kinds of different things to change their drives. And they won't have any success there because of the religious rituals or whatever it is, method is they're trying to use, don't have any success in changing the drives, because the drives are dictated by what? The strong desires. And when temptation comes, when those strong desires are there, it's impossible to resist. You know, you ever wondered why temptations, God allows temptations to come into your life that are so powerful? Why would God let me be tempted with such a strong temptation? He knows I'm going to cave into it. Well, remember, those temptations don't just come out of nowhere. My sinful desires have been reaching out to that temptation. My heart has been going out towards that temptation for the last 6 months. I shouldn't be surprised when finally the temptation comes to me. I mean, if I've been walking around saying, I'm open to temptation, should be no surprise when it finally comes. You can't change the actions without changing the thought patterns. You can't change the thought patterns without addressing the drives. You can't address the drives without doing something about the evil desires. And the evil desires, as a result of that initial idolatry of bowing to self and always being obedient to the impulses of self. It's the decision to worship the wrong God at the very outset. And once you make that decision to do that, you get in a pattern of worshiping that God, the whole process is in play, and there's absolutely no stopping it. Once the process has started, the only way to address this is cut it right at the very root. Turn to Philippians 3. Self is really a harsh God. It's an obnoxious God. It'll scream at you to obey its every wish, no matter how small the wish is. I mean, you can just be standing in line at a gas station, totally minding your own business, and you haven't done anything wrong, and then all of a sudden self is screaming at you, "Get me a Snickers bar! Ah! Feed me! You know? Give me a sense of pleasure! Right now!" And if you think a spoiled 2-year-old kid can throw a fit, you look at the fit self will throw if you try and say no to it for the first time in a while. It'll tell you that you're going to die if you don't feed it. Philippians 3, verse 19, says, talking about false teachers, it says their God is their stomach. And that's not just talking about food, it's talking about appetite in general. That is, they're constantly obedient to... Now, listen, of course you have to feed your appetite. You get hungry, you need to eat. You don't eat, you're going to die. You get thirsty, you need to drink. I mean, you need to be responsive to your appetites, but there's a difference in the way you're responsive to it. You can respond to them when, as you're the one who's in charge, and your mind is making decisions about what your body will have or not have, and when it makes a demand, your mind decides whether or not you're going to respond to the demand, or you can have a relationship with it that's a worshiper-God relationship, where it just makes a demand and you respond. And there's no question whether or not you're going to respond, you just do. How do you get to the point where your stomach is your God? Well, look at the rest of Philippians 3:19. Their God is their stomach and their mind is set on earthly things. We're right back to verses 1 and 2 of Colossians 3. So that's why at the outset you have to set your mind on things above. None of this will work otherwise if you go on a pattern of earthly thinking. Setting your mind on earthly things results in being subject to the God of self. So, you tell your body, don't make demands on me. I decide when and if you get anything. And just take control of yourself. When I think about my flesh, this week I've been, you know, studying all this, and every time my flesh makes a demand on me, this week I've been thinking about Dagon. I've been calling my flesh Dagon. Dagon is a great name for your flesh. I'm way behind on my time here, so we don't have time to look at it. But 1 Samuel 5, you know the story that probably the Israelites. I mean, Dagon was a god that the Philistines worshipped. And it was, the scholars say, it was a half-fish, half-man type thing. And they worshipped Dagon. And the Philistines one time captured Israel's Ark of the Covenant. And they thought they captured Israel's God. And they say, oh, good, now we can use this God along with our God. Because that's what idolaters do, is use their God. And so they brought the Ark of the Covenant, and they said, so we'll set it in the temple right next to Dagon. Now we got two gods. And so they set it up. They come back in the next morning, and Dagon is flat on his face. And so they prop it back up. They say, oh, our God tipped over. And so they put it back up. And they go back, and they come back in the next day, and Dagon is flat on his face again. This time his head is cut off, and his hands are cut off. And so they say, we have got to get rid of the ark. I got to read you this verse. When the men of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, the ark of God, the God of Israel, must not stay here with us because his hand is heavy upon us and upon Dagon our God, that we keep having to prop back up and glue back together. Now you would think, well, isn't the logical thing, wouldn't the logical thing to be get rid of Dagon? Dagon has to be the most pathetic loser of a god ever been. I mean, you think about the gods, the powerful gods. I mean, if you thought that there was a whole pantheon of gods and you imagine them warring against each other and using the powers of nature, I mean, what can Dagon do? Could Dagon command the wind and the waves? Could Dagon move the stars around? Could he hurl the sun at his enemy? Dagon couldn't so much as tip himself upright. He was dependent on his worshippers just to glue him back together. He couldn't even get up off his face. Incredible impotence. Talk about a lame God. Dagon was a joke. And you read the story and your first thought is, why would anybody ever worship a God like that? So that's what I've been calling my flesh, Dagon. So I can remind myself, I'm not going to worship a God, a worthless God like that. You know, I get an impulse, some kind of a demand, an unreasonable demand my flesh makes, and I just say, oh, nice try, Dagon. I'm not going to worship you. You're a joke of a God. So anyway, it all goes back to who you're willing to worship. Ask yourself how responsive you are to your flesh. Rid yourself of covetousness and the resulting sins, because verse 6 says, because of these, the wrath of God is coming. And now we understand why. Now we understand why there's wrath. God has wrath against those kinds of sins. People have wondered, why does God get so upset about, you know, one guy sleeping with a woman who, they don't have a ring on their finger, so what? I mean, what? Who does it hurt? Or pornography. Our society is at a total loss to understand what's wrong with pornography. They can't figure out why it's bad. They call it a victimless crime. Aside from the fact of the countless women who are brutally abused and the harm that comes to women as a result of pornography, that's not even the worst part of it. That's not even the worst part of pornography. The victim of pornography ultimately is God. It's not a victimless crime. It's a terrible crime because it's self-worship. It's bowing to desire, the ultimate self, the ultimate God. What is the greatest good in the universe? The greatest reality in the universe? What is it? Isn't that the greatest good in the universe? The glorification of God? So what's the worst sin in the universe? Isn't it exalting something up higher than God? If the ultimate good is the supremacy of God, then the ultimate sin is trying to lift myself higher than God. That's self-worship, idolatry. That's why the wrath of God is kindled against it. It's that serious. And Paul traces the sin of sexual sin back to the sin of covetousness. You can do that with any sin of taking. It all traces back. Why do people steal things? Don't they steal things as a result of thought patterns, of craving something they want, as a result, and those thought patterns come from the drives that they want to get things, and don't those drives come from strong desires that are a result of self-worship, greed? Any form of lack of self-control can be traced back to the same very serious sin, whether it's overeating, or a habit you can't break, or laziness, or whatever it is. It all traces back to idolatry. When the desire to be lazy, or to eat too much, or watch hours and hours of TV, whatever it is, when you face that desire, is obeying the impulse of your body the first priority? If so, then you're doing nothing less than declaring, I am God, and then bowing the knee to self. That kind of greedy life reflects the attitude that everything and everyone exists for me, for my benefit, which is another way of saying, I am God. And the question isn't, do you think that in your mind? Nobody thinks that way in their mind. The question is, does your life patterns communicate that? Self-discipline and mastery of your appetites is not a small matter. If you desire to gain self-control over yourself, so that you can save money, or so that you can be more healthy, or so that you can shed a few pounds, or so that you can live in a cleaner environment, folks, those motives are way too low.